Welcome back to the History of South Africa podcast with me, your host, Des Latham. Episode 237, Going Native, Coconuts, Hindu Immigrants and the Church and State in Natal. But first, we'll cover the first years of responsible government in the Cape, and we'll hear about the Langali-Baleli debacle part one, called a rebellion. But after you listen to the story, perhaps you'll decide to describe the chief of the Amahlubi's actions as self-defense. Although responsible government had come comparatively late for the Cape Colony, the transition in many ways was still too early. It had come 20 years after New Zealand and the state of Victoria, in what was to become Australia, had achieved responsible government. The Easterners of the Cape were only partly reconciled to the rule by a Cape Town elite. Widely differing personalities in the Eastern Cape made cooperation difficult. There was the staunchly liberal William Porter, opposed to the stiff proto-racist Robert Godlinton. Then there were rising stars like Francis William Rates Jr., the legislative leader of Beaufort West at the age of 28, and the 6'4" giant Jonix Merriman, who was somewhat erratic, but his instinct for decency and his broad human empathy made him attractive to most who met him, Boer and Brit. He was of his time, of course, intellectually convinced of the brotherhood of man, as long as it meant white brotherhood. Like many colonists of the period, he found it impossible to deal with black South Africans on a sympathetic basis. There was the less attractive Gordon Sprigg, conceited, a small man, big in ambition, but capable of folly and deception, as historian Frank Welsh explains. There was the impressive Lion of Beaufort, John Maltino, who I've mentioned before, the first leader of the Cape when it achieved responsible government. Maltino owned 100,000 acres of well-tended land and ran a thriving business. John Henry de Villiers was also in this first group of Cape leaders, distinguishing himself well off the future Lord de Villiers Graaf. Born in 1842, his public life was to fall in the most complicated and controversial period of early South African history. I have his biography written by Eric Walker, and it's a running commentary from his point of view on the whole history of the country. Two interests dominated his life, law and federation. By the time he died, his influence on South African law would be arguably greater than any other person, presiding over the senior court for more than 40 years. He also took a keen interest in politics, mostly directed towards the idea of federating South African states and colonies. De Villiers had what was called a balanced affection for both Britain and South Africa. Speak of an affection for Britain, but not necessarily balanced with an affection for Africa. These were the English colonists of Natal. If you cast your eyes eastwards to that colony, you have met a group of settlers who were bitter in their attitude towards Boers and blacks, and for whom J.H. de Villiers, the future de Villiers Graaf Lord, was a threat to their preference for going with Britain. Retaining close ties to the old country, England, the idea of a federation would sit uncomfortably for most Natalians. Since the earliest days of Port Natal settlement, dating back to the 1830s, the group of men and women had planted the flag of Britain firmly in their hearts, even as they planted their feet firmly on a stretch of subtropical Africa. More xenophobic than the English-speaking Eastern Cape folks, even more fearful and dismissive of their own black brethren. Blacks who owned land in Natal were technically allowed to vote, as in the Cape, but every stratagem was employed to weaken this right. There was a high property qualification in Natal, and other restrictions had been added through the 1860s, when black Natalians were not allowed even to petition for admission to the electoral roll until they'd cleared a series of increasingly high hurdles. 7 years of exemption from customary law being the first hurdle. Then three white men had to sign approval of the black Natalian gaining the vote, which was a complete negation of the colour-blind principle which was supposed to be driving this political right. Once the black Natalian had managed to clear these hurdles, believe it or not, there was one more. He had to seek permission from the lieutenant governor. The list of black voters in Natal was not very long. By the 1870s, the system of labour they entered precluded most from gaining access to private land in any meaningful way. Often we would hear the usual note about how, if only people just worked the land as farmers, they would be able to afford to vote. The reality was they faced extra taxes, far beyond those paid by settlers. There were hut taxes, which settlers did not pay, dog taxes, which they did not pay, marriage registration taxes, ditto, Customs duties on implements like hoes and plows all pushed black farmers into the need to earn hard cash more quickly. Most of these avoided working as farm labourers, therefore the need to import Indian labour, as you've heard. Some of the reluctance was because most black men and women preferred labouring on their own land and not someone else's. Added to this was a more pressing economic fact. They could earn far more as transport drivers, muleteers, wagon drivers, and labourers on public works, including roads, bridges, and government structures. Those jobs were better paying than the farm worker. Others, policeman, government messenger, post carrier, cook, nurse, groom, and domestic worker. The people who lived in the reserves were freed from the worst extractions of chiefs inside Zululand. A man could not be ruined by witchcraft allegations in Natal, and so a substantial black peasantry emerged. This elicited much opprobrium from settlers who needed cheap labour. Magistrates and Natal officials were reined in by imperial officials when they tried to force chiefs to order their followers to provide 6 man-hours per 11 huts as labour to the farmers. Natal Prime Minister John Robinson wrote in his book, A Lifetime in South Africa, that black Natalians were leading a life of almost idyllic freedom and repose. Settlers were growing more furious. In the first years of colonial rule, there was little shortage of land for black occupation, even though the population began to expand rapidly. Unallocated crown lands belonged to the state until individuals or institutions were granted rights. So it was deeply ironic then that one of Zulu King Cetshwayo Kampande's most trusted chiefs and one of his most important was Englishman John Donne. He was the antithesis of everything that the urbanized English settler espoused, living and marrying into the Zulu people, his descendants fiercely proud members of a large clan today. He elicited from those around him the phrase, "going native," which is one of the most insidious relics of colonial thought. On the surface, it pretends to describe the act of Europeans adopting the dress, customs, or ways of the people they encountered. Yet, the phrase carries within it the full weight of colonial superiority, the assumption that European culture was the standard, and that to step outside of it was to descend to lapse, to betray one's civilization. It is a phrase that betrays not only arrogance, but also blindness, for the colonizers themselves lived inside their own fragile narratives, their truths riven with distortions and contradictions and fear. Yet this framing distorts the reality. Dunn did not abandon his identity, nor did he lose himself in some imagined cultural wilderness. Instead, he maneuvered between worlds, making pragmatic choices in a landscape of shifting power. His dozens of Zulu wives, his acceptance of chiefly responsibilities, and his role in Zulu diplomacy were not symptoms of cultural weakness, but acts of negotiation, survival, and influence. The idea of becoming Zulu was to become powerful in the region dominated by the AmaZulu. It was a social and a political decision, one which most settlers of the day could not understand was crucial to becoming South African. To describe Dunn as having gone native is to miss the point entirely. It ignores the colonial structures that sought to police identity and cultural boundaries while exploiting the very same entanglements for advantage. More importantly, it erases the agency of the Zulu themselves, who regarded Dunn as useful, integrated him on their own terms, and judged his place within their society. What the phrase hides is the deeper truth that cultural contact is not a simple matter of adoption or abandonment, but of constant exchange, dialogue, and recalibration. Cetshwayo used Dunn to his own advantage as the pressure of the British Empire bore down on Zululand. Neither was fooled by the other. Their relationship was one of calculation and pragmatism, born in a moment when power had to be measured carefully, and alliances, however unlikely, were instruments of survival. There is a persistent trend, both in colonial records and in some modern retellings, to patronize African chiefs who entered into these kinds of relationships with white men and women. Too often they are painted as dupes or sellouts, men supposedly blinded by novelty, bribed by trinkets, or stripped of authenticity by association. In today's language, one sometimes hears the same contempt distilled into another odious phrase, labelling them coconuts. Such terms are linguistic concoctions of the imbecile, crude ways of discrediting leaders who were in fact making shrewd choices in impossible circumstances. The same applies to those who claim cultural appropriation. What these labels erase is real intelligence at work, the ability of people to weigh options in a landscape where violence is pressed on every side. To treat them as compromised because they engage with outsiders is to misunderstand the art of statecraft in a world already entangled by this empire. It is prejudice masquerading as analysis. After that little interlude, land is the topic, and black farmers were occupying lands on a profit-sharing basis, contributing part of the proceeds of their work to the white owner, or by selling produce to pay these hut and other taxes. They were sharecroppers, but they were called squatters. By the early 1870s, there were 375,000 black people living in Natal, many refugees from the Zulu civil wars, and 43,000 of these were living on crown land. The others were divided between reserves, mission stations, and privately owned settler land. Edendale Mission Station is a good example of how early peasant farmers became successful quite rapidly, with the local people setting up their own company, which eventually owned more than 32,000 acres, owned by blacks, run by blacks. William Africa was one of these. He owned 1,600 acres himself and had shares in several other Natal farms. And yet, these prosperous few enjoyed zero political rights, limited though they were at the time in the Cape. Into this truculent mix, there emerged another group on the Natal landscape, the indentured Indian labourers, who were now beginning to earn their freedom. Most preferred to remain in Natal rather than return to India. At first, the government of India was happy to cooperate to facilitate immigration to Natal, but when the treatment accorded to the unfortunate Indians by white Natalians became known, the Indian authorities objected and banned any further immigration. So it was double irony then that most of the former indentured Indians remained in Natal, despite their treatment at the hands of the settlers. This layer cake of irony piles up. Logic seems abandoned, doesn't it? Ah, yes, South African history. The fact that the Indian government was responsible to a different department of the British government in London and had independence in administering its own affairs was to lead to constant friction between Indian and South African authorities, as Gandhi would find out in a few more years. To explain why most of these Indian indentured workers preferred to remain behind after their period of working on sugar farms had elapsed, it was all because of one thing: land. They were given land to the value of their return passage if they preferred to stay. And then another ruling by the Indian government was also in their favour, because the Indian government had insisted that a large proportion of the immigrants from India be women. So that meant a permanent Indian community developed, families. And when word got out about the opportunities, well, more traders, artisans and professionals like doctors and lawyers began to make their way to Natal as what was called the Passage Indian. They appeared to integrate more easily into the colonial ways, while the English settlers held them at arm's length. Indians did not attract missionary attention. They were left to their own devices as mainly Hindu, some Muslim and even some Christian. They began to influence the steady growth of Natal. Meanwhile, the diamond fields were draining away the labour pool. Zulu workers could earn 10 times what they earned back in Natal just by walking to Kimberley and sieving for diamonds. The walk was difficult and dangerous enough. The work was deadly, but the returns were vast when taking into account the level of earnings of the day. Administering the AmaZulu and other clans of Natal was Secretary for Native Affairs Theophilus Shepston. He had used his intimate knowledge of black language and customs to act the part of a Zulu paramount. By 1870, Shepston had spent half a century among both isiXhosa and isiZulu speakers, and he had honed his system down to rewarding cooperative chiefs and dispossessing those who showed recalcitrance. Shepston's system had achieved a fair measure of tranquility, but virtually no advancement for the people he administered. There were very few education and training entities in Natal because its economic advancement was way behind the Cape. Bishop John William Colenso had emerged as a key figure in the colony, financing his own education by schoolmastering and publishing textbooks before he was installed as the first bishop of Natal in 1858. We've met Colenso previously, a man who was intellectually honest, answering in what he regarded as truthful ways when it came to serving his black flock. Colenso embroiled himself in a series of clashes with other members of the Anglican leadership because he realized that parts of the Old Testament were difficult to explain logically to his flock. He said it was poetic license rather than gospel truth, to mix a metaphor. Most serious scholars had already come to that conclusion, but in the hot and heady atmosphere of early colonial Natal, this would just not do. The Archbishop Robert Gray of Cape Town deposed Colenso in an act that was short-sighted and driven by hysterical frenzy. Gray appointed his own deployee, James Green, as Dean of Pietermaritzburg to manage affairs of the church. Green and Colenso would live together in this little town for 20 years without exchanging a single word, such was the bad blood. And yet both distrusted poor, inoffensive William McCrory, dispatched to Maritzburg as the alternative bishop. Colenso and Shepston were doomed to clash. The former a fraternal friend of the black people of Natal, the latter a paternal father figure, as he cast himself, guiding the people on the trail to subservience to the English flag. And the white colonists? Well, they alternatively hated and despised both of these men. A sea of troubles faced the folks of this colony, because an Amatlubi chief called Langali Balele was defiantly independent. A man of considerable dignity and high reputation as a rainmaker amongst black Natalians and even some white. His land lay on the strategic route from Durban to the diamond fields in Griqualand West, and he knew it. When he'd fled from Zululand during the many internal wars and clashes amongst the AmaZulu, the British had allowed him to settle close to the border with Zululand. Then the Amatlubi were moved to the foothills of the Drakensberg to act as a barrier against the incursions of the sand raiders I mentioned in episode 152. They had prospered here, raising cattle and sheep and trading both inland and with the colonists of the coast, and now the semi-independent kingdom lay in the path of those who would mine diamonds. Langali Balele's people had spent a few years working at what was to become Kimberley, and they had come home with material purchased with the wages, including guns and horses. The colonists of Natal viewed these developments with growing alarm. What happened next is for next episode. Please rate the podcast on your favorite platform. It helps elevate its visibility. You can head off to desmondlatham.blog, where I'm about to load updates about the last few episodes. You can email me from there and sign up for my newsletter. Until next, goodbye.